Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. How are my loyal listeners? Thank you for your continued support. We have an amazing show for you all because boarding the mothership is Will Wheaton. You know him as Wesley Crusher in Star Trek: The Next Generation. He now hosts the Reading Room on Paramount Plus and is the author of Still Just a Geek. Now come join me as we go traversing the stars. Hello, Mr. Wheaton. Thank you so much for coming to the Traversing the Stars podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here. Nice to see you.
It's a big deal to me. I'm a big fan of yours. You're fantastic. So thank you for coming. You know, and I really enjoyed reading your book, Still Just a Geek. I thought it was really well done. And honestly, Just a Geek, because, you know, they're connected. And I really like the idea and how it embraced geekdom and how much pride you took in geekdom. So when do you think it became okay in society to embrace geekdom, and how much do you feel pride in your part?
I've never really felt any kind of shame or weirdness about loving the things that I love. I felt pretty lonely because I didn't know a lot of other people who loved things that we consider to be the primary kind of nerd or geek hobbies, right? Like, I just didn't know a lot of people who loved Star Trek the way that I did, and I didn't know anybody who liked to play D&D the way that I did outside of like two friends. And I never felt ashamed of it, and I never felt weird about it. I just felt like kind of sad that I didn't encounter more people who felt the same way that I did about it. I think there was the moment that I am really aware of, where I felt a massive cultural shift, where the larger kind of mainstream popular culture opened up and allowed the stuff I already loved to like take up some really valuable real estate. I feel like that would have been right around the time the Fellowship of the Ring came out. I remember that starting this massive like migration of people who we always would have thought of as muggles into what we always thought of as our world. And I didn't see it only with people who thought, oh, I like the Lord of the Rings, I like this trilogy, I like fantasy. I started to see new people in tabletop gaming that were just sort of like, they were kind of intrigued by the fantasy elements that were so important in so many of the games that we played. They saw people starting to be like really openly proud of all of these things that we loved. And then I saw, and the moment that I absolutely knew without any doubt at all that like we had won, that we were like absolutely, the things that we loved were like, everybody loved them now. Moment I knew that that was real and we were never going back to like being kind of cloistered in basements and stuff was when I started seeing the gatekeepers show up. When I started seeing the toxic men, and they're always men and they're almost always white dudes who are just like, how dare you come and try to love this thing that I love? And that was when I knew, oh, okay. Now these people feel threatened, so we have absolutely succeeded in bringing all of these people who never felt comfortable with our culture and never felt like they could come and be part of it. We're coming in, and we're living in that space with us. That was when I really began to feel it. Would have been about then, and then it really, I watched it all sort of like coalesce and really become a thing over the course of that entire trilogy.
Yeah, and you know, and obviously we had the Marvel movies and then Big Bang Theory, which once again, we own TV, own the movies. And as a geek growing up, I always thought in my head was, I can't wait for everyone to love what I love because it would just make my life easier. Why do you think there are the gatekeepers then who are like, not get out of my shop? You know,
I
you're
think
not,
that
you're not,
gatekeep,
you're not
gatekeeping
us.
Exists in everything. It doesn't matter what it is. Gatekeeping exists in, I mean, there's a movie called Diner that I really enjoy, a Barry Sonnenfeld movie from the 70s. And Danny Stern plays a character in it who is getting married to, I think, Ellen Burstyn. I can't remember who the other actor is, but she's great. And he forces her to take a football test before they get married. He loves football so much that she has to take this huge test and pass the test or they won't get married. And it's stupid. And everybody knows it's stupid. I think even he knows it's stupid, but the movie is set in the 1950s. And it kind of tracks as a thing just like that a man would do. Like, it's not enough that you accept me. Now you have to prove to me, right? So she takes the test and she misses it by like, she misses passing by like a question or two questions or something. And he's like, I guess the wedding's off. And literally everybody around him is like, the fuck is wrong with you? She did all of that bullshit for you. And because she missed one thing, you're like not going to marry her. It all comes out of his insecurity and his need to feel special. I think we see the gatekeeping now because it comes out of the insecurity of people who need to feel special. There was something that made them feel special, right? They were a hermit in a cave and they had something that people had to go all the way up the mountain to get. And like, he got to decide if they came into the cave or not. And we were like, hey, guess what? This doesn't only live in your cave. Right. It's literally everywhere and we're making more of it. And now the thing that makes that guy feel special is threatened and maybe even completely taken away. And that's where I think gatekeeping comes from. I think it comes from insecurity, and it's a real giant bummer. It's one of the reasons that, like, you know, I and a lot of my peers really kind of work against it. To say, like, you know, we say it in Star Trek, science fiction is for everyone. We say it. I'm a huge LA Kings and I'm a huge hockey fan, right? Like, hockey is for everyone. You know, we say these things in the context of it being June and it being Pride Month and reminding everyone that there is a place at every table for every single person. I would just maybe inappropriately slide up next to that and just say, like, I just want to say that, like, everybody else come on in, right? Like, take that spirit that we're expressing and saying, like, we will not allow you to push people out. Let's expand that and bring more people in.
You know, I think one of my favorite quotes in the book, So Just a Geek, you said, you define geekdom as the way you love something. And I think the next part in that book that I love the most as well is that you go into a discussion on how fans of sports are sport geeks. Exactly. It's the same damn thing. You think you're a jock. You think you're not a geek, but you're doing the same damn thing.
It's really fun to be talking about that to a person who hasn't considered it and watch the revelation happen, right? It's sort of like you see them turn on the color television set after watching black and white forever. And it's really fun.
Right.
It is... it is an artificial barrier that is created by people in power to pit us against one another. And there are power structures that really benefit from like this unnecessary division of like jocks and nerds. There is a, I mean, it's just, this has been going on as long as humans have existed, right? It's just, it's like, people who really benefit from us being like at each other's throats do everything they can to keep us that way.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we really are in the golden age of geekdom. I mean, we're at a part in time where not only do you have embracing geeks and entertainment, but we're at a time of very strongly anti-bullying. We're in ideas of Pride Month. I feel like we're coming together where it's beginning to sever those walls between what is a geek, the nerds, the jocks, you know, as saying, we're all pretty much the same in just different corners of that same idea.
Yeah. You know, there's so much right now. There's like whatever you love, there's just a ton of it somewhere that you can enjoy. And I really think it is terrific, especially as it relates to popular media and as it relates to fiction. We're talking about speculative fiction and speculative storytelling, and I think that's wonderful. Everyone I know, and this is like the pearl of anecdote is not data, but all of the people I've known in my life who are attracted to science fiction and fantasy and speculative fiction are people who are in some way unsatisfied with the world as it is and wanting to make some kind of change and wanting to be inspired to find whatever that future is. And I'm really happy that there's that much speculative fiction on television and in the movies right now. And that speculative fiction, by its very definition, has to be extremely diverse and extremely inclusive. And we're at this moment where this idiot wrote this thing for Fox News, and I could just stop there, and that would cover everything that's ever been written for Fox News. But the idiot wrote a thing for Fox News where Star Trek's too woke, and I was like, where the fuck have you been for 55 years? Like, really? And also, P.S., woke is awesome. Don't let right-wing pieces of shit take a beautiful description of being awake with your eyes wide open and fully aware of everything that is going on around you and make being asleep with your eyes closed with other people's experiences completely shut off from you while you slumber safely in a dream the hope for alternative. Wilson Cruz, who I stan, recently wrote on his Instagram that being woke is, that's the way to be, man. Like, it is being awake and it is being aware of what goes on around you. And that's what speculative fiction has always been about. And it's always helped us get a little bit closer to that ideal by telling us about, holding up a mirror to ourselves through alien races and space travel and, you know, weird sci-fi devices and things like that.
Well, that's why I think I really like what's been going on with they call it the new Trek. I mean, Discovery does such a good job of introducing these characters. I mean, they handle, you know, there's a homosexual couple there that is perfectly defined.
That family,
a great relationship.
Culbertz and Stamets and the family that they have formed with Adira and Ian's character, whose name I'm just blanking on at the moment, it's just beautiful. I love that. And I think about all the people I meet who tell me that Star Trek gave them media where they could see themselves, where they saw themselves reflected. And there's this beautiful story of Whoopi Goldberg seeing Nichelle Nichols on Star Trek when Whoopi was a little girl in the 60s and in the 70s, and her saying to her mom, "Mama, we made it. One of us is in space. One of us is in the future." And she talked about how that representation was so important to her that she wanted to be part of the next generation. And apocryphally, I believe this story to be true, but I've never been able to officially confirm it. We were going to be canceled at the end of our not very great first season. And Whoopi Goldberg said, "Hey, I'm the biggest star on the planet in 1989, and I want to be part of Star Trek. Please let me do that." And when the biggest movie star on the planet wants to be part of your television show, you do whatever it takes to make that possible. They gave us a second season. They built us a new set. They put some money into the show. They gave us a chance to really find ourselves. I don't know if Star Trek The Next Generation survives past its first season without Whoopi Goldberg's involvement. And Whoopi Goldberg's not involved if Nichelle Nichols isn't in the original Star Trek. Nichelle Nichols doesn't stay in the original Star Trek if Martin Luther King Jr. doesn't say to her, "It's so important to everyone and everything that we care about that you're there." So if you look at this trail that goes all the way back to 1966, it's like, Black women are saved Star Trek, and Black women are saving the future. And it is super appropriate that Stacey Abrams is the president of Earth in Star Trek Discovery. Right. And quite honestly, listen, I'm saying this is a statement that I'm making for myself personally. I'm not speaking on behalf of Star Trek, anybody else associated with Star Trek. I am not speaking as the host of the Red Room. I'm speaking as myself, Will Wheaton, a person who is a massive fan of Star Trek. If that bothers you, too fucking bad. Deal with it. If you want to have Joe Rogan in space, go make it yourself and see how successful it is. Nobody wants that garbage. What everybody wants to see and what is inspiring and beautiful and what is moving the vast majority of humans forward in our world right now is exactly the kind of woke Star Trek that you're all mad about. So great, I'm mad about it.
I mean, that's the part that always shocked me the most is like, if you're a fan of Star Trek, you've been a fan of Star Trek for a while, you watch these shows, if you're not attempting to become woke, I mean, we all may have certain ignorances, being ignorant at some level that we're trying to work through, but if you're not trying to reach that level of wokeness, are you understanding the show you're watching to begin with? You know, I mean, what is it that you're
watching? Well, Star Trek doesn't demand that you sit down and have a deep philosophical discussion about like every moral issue that faces us today, but it absolutely lays it out there in case you want to have it. And this is where I think really good science fiction is at its absolute best. When science fiction can be distraction and entertainment and just fun for the person sitting on the on this side of the sofa, and it can be deeply meaningful and inspiring and stimulating and validating and all these other things for a person sitting just a couple of feet away from them. That's where science fiction and speculative fiction, I think, really, really, really shines. So I don't want to give the impression that like when you sit down to watch this, you're getting ready for like a big progressive lecture. That's just not what it is at all. It's just beautiful representation and it's really beautiful storytelling. And it is showing us a possible future that is really worth fighting for. And I loved how this season of Star Trek Picard showed us the potential of a fascist future, which is terrifying to me, which is really close. Like, I feel like we are living through the collapse of American democracy. And I feel like the next two elections are going to decide if we are overrun by a fascist minority that completely takes control of the country, or if somehow we manage to fight against that and push back. I don't know. I don't know where that's going to be. But seeing that in Picard, that potential future was terrifying to me. And hopefully terrifying to other people as well.
I would hope so. I hope there's no one who's watching that going, the way it should be. I don't see the problem here. because you did mention Picard a little bit. I did want to hit on this part. I know it's a spoiler, but it's been a while since the show has stopped here. You show up at the very last episode of as the Traveler, which I thought was the coolest way full circle with your character. Yeah, and I had a few questions on that one. The first one is, did it feel for you, because having read So Just a Geek, and you've had some issues with your role in Star Trek and your history growing up, we'll get into a little bit of that later. Did that feel like the final full circle in completing your
Yeah, it was extraordinary closure. It was so meaningful to me. I spent a lot of time, as you know, from reading Just a Geek, I spent a lot of time being really uncomfortable with Wesley Crusher and feeling that I was unable to love and embrace and celebrate him the way that that I can now. And I'm sad that I wasn't always able to do that. I'm sad that that's something that is only, you know, relatively recent. This version of Wesley, this Wesley who's been a traveler for 20 something years, he is so much what I wanted to bring to the character, and all of the things that he expresses to Corey are very much what I, nearly 50-year-old Will, wanted to express to like 20 year old Will, 18, 17, 15 year old Will. Getting to be that wise, almost shamanic old soul character. It felt really good. I don't know if I will have the opportunity to explore that part of Wesley Crusher on camera ever again. I think it's probably never gonna happen. But I absolutely have the opportunity to experience that in like the fan fiction I've been writing, because it's just fun for me. you know, I've got the next couple of books kind of in the queue, but I have to have something going for myself that's just fun. That's just like how I unwind at the end of the day. And at the moment, it's writing fan fiction about Wesley Crusher and about Wesley the Traveler. So I've spent a fair amount of time with him thinking about all of those things. And it's been really fun. But to your question, for me personally, yeah, it was great. It was beautiful to be there. And then when the episode finally aired, and it was such a surprise to everyone, I remember talking to PR about it because we ready room, and I just didn't know if the audience was going to be given any indication that it was coming or what. And the way it was described to me was that we wanted the audience to feel like they had just been they were a quarterback that had been sacked, right? Like they never saw it coming, and all of a sudden they're on the ground and the ball's out of their hands, and what is going on? And it is my understanding from the people I've spoken to that that's very much the reaction that they experienced, and they really loved it. And I've heard from people who had this moment of hearing my voice and going, oh my God, is that Wesley? And then it was, right? So out of all of that, the universal celebration, the celebration of Wesley, the celebration of me, the joy and the love. And this came after about a week of the same type of response, but it was folks being real upset that Wesley wasn't in season 3 of Picard. And just toxic fandom was so cruel to me. Toxic fandom was so loud and relentless. I was bullied so much. As a child, I was bullied by adults. And culture went along with it. Society allowed it. People, never my cast, but people who were adults involved in Star Trek absolutely participated in the bullying of Wesley Crusher and the cruelty toward me. And I was just a kid, you know? And what the world didn't know at the time is I was an abused child. I was exploited by my parents. My father was an abusive bully to me. He had been emotionally abusive to me my entire life. He became physically abusive to me when I was working on Star Trek. I was having an unbelievably hard time in my life. And like, as someone who had been a fan of Star Trek forever and ever since I was a little boy, that I was finally part of it meant so much to me. But a big part of the defining characteristic of my relationship with the guy that was my dad was that like nothing I did was good enough for him, and he didn't care about me or anything I did. Well, here I am. I'm on Star Trek, you guys. Like, maybe he'll finally care. It's a really big deal. And he doesn't. And now here come all these loud, cruel fans to tell me that I suck, that I'm ruining it, that like, and it's me. It's you, 14 and 15 year old Will Wheaton, not writers who wrote on the original series, who absolutely should have known better, who should have stood up and said, I take some responsibility for this, instead of hosting a panel called Solving the Wesley Problem that was all about attacking me. Like, there could have been different ways to handle this. At that time, it hurts so much. And what I just thought was, oh my God, he's right about me. I am terrible. I'm the worst. I don't deserve this. I took it all to heart. And then Rick Berman was not a great boss. Rick Berman treated me like property the way my mom and dad treated me like property. So when I had this, I saw this brief little glimmer of this opportunity where I could be like, I don't have to do this. I can stand up for myself. I can go be my own person. And the way that that expressed itself was quitting Star Trek when I was about 17. And a lot of the original Just a Geek is about like feeling like, well, that was a bad choice and that was a bad mistake. And a huge part of still Just a Geek is realizing, wait a minute, I actually needed that journey and I needed that space and I needed that time to go away, very similar to the way Wesley needed to go away from Starfleet and join the Travelers and find a different calling in his life and do different things with his energy. He wasn't there to be the starship captain that everyone expected him to be. He wanted to be something different. Well, holy crap, man, does that mirror my life? Like, I never wanted to be an actor. It was never important to me. And I certainly never wanted to be famous. I never wanted all of that attention. I never wanted to go, like, be at Hollywood parties. I never wanted to be chased by paparazzi. I just wanted to be, when I was little, I just wanted to be a kid. And then when I was older, I just kind of wanted to go to school and figure out what I wanted to do with myself. So Wesley leaving Starfleet, me leaving Star Trek, and the two of us coming back at this particular moment in our lives is deeply symbolic and extraordinarily healing for me as a person. And the interactions I've had with my fellow Star Trek fans since that episode aired make me feel like an enormous part of the audience is getting the same thing out of the performance and the appearance that I did. And that feels really good.
I mean, I would totally agree. I mean, when I saw, I was thinking to myself, spinoff, it's going to be a spinoff, Star Trek is a spinoff, we got to do this one. And I also think about this, and I don't know if I'm reading too much into it, like the metaphor of how life works out. When I'm reading Still Just a Geek, and you talked about Wesley Crusher's role in Star Trek Nemesis, and how he kind of was supposed to come back to being in the Academy somehow and blah, blah, blah. But what they did with the Traveler in Picard seemed to be the more interesting continuation of the character. And I mean, I'm just reading too much about it. Like, that's kind of like Will Wheaton a little bit. Like, if he had stayed and what was, it wouldn't have been where he came now. And what he is now is way more interesting than what he would have been.
Yeah, if this I think I wrote about this in the book. I can't say for sure. Like, I've been talking about it almost every day for like a month and a half after having written it for 2.5 years. It's all just becoming this blur. But had I stayed on Star Trek instead of leaving when I did, I would have been in all the movies. I would be extraordinarily wealthy and I would be miserable. I wouldn't have anything. I never would have met my wife. I never would have become a dad. I never would have reckoned with the reality of my abusive childhood. I never would have quit drinking. I never would have found my voice. I never would have grown into the best possible version of me. I would have continued to be my mom's thing that she used to feel popular and get money for the family. And I think that if Wesley had stayed in Starfleet, he would have been the captain of a starship and a very good captain of a starship, and so lonely and unhappy and constantly asking himself, did I do the right thing? I feel like I missed it, which leads me to my very favorite episode of Star Trek of all time, which is Tapestry, where Q gives Picard the opportunity to live a different life. And when Picard does that, he finds out, oh, I need those things that I regret to be the person that I am right now. It is not a coincidence that Tapestry is my favorite episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, and I talk about it all the time. It is not a coincidence that I was able to have a couple of conversations with writers from the Star Trek universe, and Wesley's line about the universe being an exquisite tapestry all came together. All of that is related. Yeah. All of that is for a reason. I got to participate in all of it. And it's even cooler than I am able to express.
You know, and I think one thing of the book that I thought was once again really fascinating was that part of the book, I think, is you defining what is success. From where you were as Wesley Crusher to later on, you're talking about your, you know, fantastic wife, your two kids, you know, your tabletop hosting Ready Room. How has your definition of what success is changed?
Am I happy doing a thing? That is how I decide if I am successful or not. Am I able to pay my bills and support my family and give my children opportunities with my job? That is my definition of success. When I finished Still Just a Geek, I remember finishing it and emailing the final, like, I'm not allowed to touch it anymore, emailing it off to my editor and having a conversation with my wife, where she was like, how do you feel? And I said, it's so weird because it's like, whatever is going to happen with this book has effectively already happened. I just haven't observed the results yet, because there's nothing I can do that is going to change what goes into someone's hand when they get this book. So if I wait to let that future play out and then decide how I feel about it, I've taken everything away from myself. I've taken all this work that I did and I've just given it to people I will never meet and said, now you decide if this was a worthwhile use of my time or not. Fuck that. Of course it was a worthwhile use of my time. It felt great. It was really hard. It was re-traumatizing. It was challenging, but it was ultimately extremely healing and extremely cathartic and very much worth all of that work. Because I decided that everything had already happened and there was nothing I could do about it, I was deliberately neutral about everything. When little things kind of came in and we got little hints that people were kind of liking it, I was really happy about that. I was relieved and pleased to know that people had gotten out of it what I wanted to put into it. And I guess I just chose to be grateful for all of that without any expectations at all. When it made the New York Times bestseller list, it took a few days for me to like wrap my head around that, because that's not something I ever expected. The person who wrote Just a Geek 20 years ago would have felt like anything less than that was a failure, and actually would absolutely have gone number 9. Why wasn't I number 7 or higher, right? Because that's how I was wired. I was wired to believe that nothing I did was good enough. I'm just really grateful that I grew out of that. I'm really grateful that I matured beyond that and I healed the wounds that made that kind of thinking possible. I've taken that idea and I've tried to expand it into other areas of my life. And I talk about it when I give talks to people. I guess philosophically, it's related to Stoicism. And I'm not a philosopher and I haven't had formal education in this, so this is probably a messy way of describing it, but essentially there's everything I can control and then there's everything else. There is the work that I do and there's everything else. And I can make a choice to find my sense of success and value and enjoyment and worthiness and all of that inside of me, separate from the work I put into the world, separate from how I am viewed in the public, right? Like, I care about what my wife thinks about me and I care about how I'm able to show up as a dad for my kids. Those are the things that are really, really important to me, and everything else is after that. When I do something and people like it, it's like I got a really awesome gift and I love it and I'm so grateful for it. But I have to make a choice to just be cool with it when it's gone. Be cool with it when it's all over, you know? I'm nearing the end of what I think is kind of the media cycle for Still Just a Geek. It's sort of slowing down now. It's been a month. It's been really busy. It's been really intense. And it's all sort of slowing down. And my kind of regular life, where I'm not talking about myself every day, is about to pick up again. And I feel like I've made some good choices because I feel like that's okay. I'm ready for that to happen so I can go back to work.
You know, and one of the cool things, about, like I said, one of the reasons I did love So Just a Geek is that, I don't know if this is the best analogy, but one that I kind of popped in my head is like, it's Infinite Mirror. It's 2021 Will commenting on 2004's Will's view of 2001 and earlier's Will. And it had me thinking that when you're writing, you know, because you're obviously you're reflecting on reflection on reflection. When you're writing, are you thinking as well about what will 2038 will think going back to and thinking going back to 2021 going, what do I think about this version of Will?
I mean, I hope that happens all the time. I hope that happens for everyone. That's growth. I hope that everyone looks back at who they are compare that to who they were and like score the victories and work on the regrets. My editor and I joked about how we're going to revisit this in another 20 years, but I think that's really unlikely.
So another great thing about Social Geek is that you're talking a little bit about issues of anxiety and depression that you dealt with.
Yeah.
Do you feel were some of that written for your audience? And were you thinking as well about, because you have so many fans, that your fans are also going to be working through their stuff by learning how you go through yours?
Every day I make a deliberate choice to be the person I need in the world. Everything I do, I do everything I can to be the person that I would want to be if I were interacting with myself. So I do my very best to show up for myself. And in doing that, I occasionally have the privilege of being able to show up for other people as well. I needed a person at every stage of my life to tell me that what was going on in my head was just biology. It was biology and complex trauma response, and that there was a way out of it, that there was a way to not suffer, that that having depression doesn't mean you're weak and it doesn't mean you're broken. It just means that you have a thing. Like, I have the Epstein-Barr virus, right? I have the chickenpox virus. I don't care. It doesn't matter. It's a thing that's inside of me. I have hazel eyes. So what? I have two healed broken bones in my body. Great. Like, none of that is remarkable. Why is my mental illness remarkable? It shouldn't be. And in order for it to get to where it shouldn't be, it's going to take people like me who have an elevated profile, who appear to have something to lose, talking about it openly, honestly, and without shame, to move the Overton window from where it was when I was growing up and really suffering because my dad didn't care about me at all. And my mom saw, if she saw it, was ashamed about it, thought it reflected poorly on her, and put her needs ahead of my needs. That is the defining characteristic of my mother. When I show up for myself, I can remind myself that that's not my fault. Mm-hmm. And there are things that I can do to feel better, to like live a full and awesome life, that this isn't some weird kind of sentence where I should go be in an institution somewhere or something like that. There's nothing noble in like silently suffering with depression because you're so tough, right? And it's not something that you can just cheer up from. Like, it's a chemical thing, and it requires a lot of work. I talk about it the way that I do so that someone else, I don't like talking about myself this way, it feels weird, so just bear with me. I know that there are people who admire me. I know that there are people who look up to me, and I know that there are people for whom I am a role model. I don't mean like, hey, look at how great I am. I just know that that's a privilege and a responsibility that I have. And my response to that privilege and responsibility is to hopefully be the person I needed for those people, whoever they are, so that they make a call to talk to a therapist, so that they sit down with their partner and say, I feel like there's this thing going on and maybe I need to talk to somebody about it to like kind of make it go away. Or so that I can get, so that I can heal from it, so I can get better from it. And because I have that privilege in my and I have that responsibility, I do my very best just not to waste it.
Well, I think it's a great thing that there are going to be people who read Still Just a Geek and see that you wrote that and make that connection with you, and hopefully to themselves, at least at the very least, will say it's not just me, or potentially here's someone who is like me and is able to manage to deal with it and is becoming successful, and I can do this as well. And I think that's fantastic that you've done that with your book, Mr. Whedon, and I had a great pleasure of talking with you, sir.
Thanks
and
a lot.
I hope to do it again one day.
Thank you very much. Stay healthy. Bye.